Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm glad you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in a moment on today's show, we'll have an episode from Our Living Lands, Harvest Public Media, and This Week in Water. And of course, we're nearing the end of our 2025 Spring Pledge Drive here at Prairie Public. And we're asking that you become a sustaining member of Prairie Public to ensure steady, reliable funding that supports trusted news, inspiring programs, and educational content year-round. Your ongoing support helps keep public media accessible to everyone in North Dakota and the Prairie region every day. We hope you'll go right now to prairiepublic.org and click on that donate button. Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. May is Stroke Awareness Month, and it's a great time to remind folks about stroke prevention, care, and everything regarding strokes. With me today, Chelsea Kuzna. She's a stroke program manager at Essentia Health. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
And Megan Carboom. She's a nurse practitioner in interventional neurology. Welcome to Main Street, Megan.
Thank you.
And
for
I want to
visit
with you. Let's start with the basics. What happens to the brain when someone has a stroke?
Great question. So when patients are coming in, they're experiencing these stroke symptoms. And there are things that are happening in the brain that are depriving the brain of oxygen, which are causing the symptoms that we're seeing.
And I'm guessing that depending on where in the brain the stroke is happening, different symptoms can present themselves in different ways for different people.
You got it. So depending on if it's in the right side of the brain, the left side of the brain, it's going to affect the body differently. In the front of the brain, in the back of the brain, all of it presents differently, which is why we look for lots of different signs and symptoms when you're coming into the hospital.
I remember when my father had a stroke, and they asked him immediately, stick out your tongue and push it to the left or to the right, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't push it to the left and stuff, and they immediately knew that was evidently a symptom that he was having.
It's always, you know, very important for stroke treatment that people are coming into the emergency room and actually calling 911 to expedite the care of stroke treatment. So if you're noticing that anybody's having any type of stroke symptoms, calling 911 to get them to the closest stroke treatment center is very important.
Let's go through all the symptoms.
Yes, so we use an acronym called BFAST to recognize signs and symptoms of stroke, and B is for balance. So any loss of balance that's sudden in patients. E is for eyes, so any loss of vision, double vision, and these are in sudden onset. F is for face, so any facial drooping on one side or the other, or goes back to your father not being able to stick his tongue out to one side or the other too, so tongue is involved with that face. A is for arms, so we have patients bring their arms up if an arm is falling down or if you have a dead hand, including that with legs as well too, so one-sided weakness, arms or legs. And S is for speech, so any sudden onset of loss of speech, speech where they can't understand you or you're not understanding them when they're talking. And T is for time or terrible headache. So terrible headache, a sudden onset of a headache that you have never experienced in your life, and you can't attribute it to any other reason why they're having this sudden onset of headache. And then T is time to call 911.
We've made that determination at home. We get to the hospital. What will happen?
You know, if you're calling 911, which is the reason why we really push for people to call 911, is we get a pre-notification from the emergency personnel, and so we are able to clear out our scanner. One of the most important things initially when you're coming in is to get a CT scan. So we're looking for what's going on, whether there's bleeding in the brain or no bleeding in the brain. So the first thing that will likely happen, they're going to make sure that they're stable and then take them to CT scanning.
There are different types of strokes. I think you mentioned that earlier. What are they?
Yes. So there's two major types of strokes, and that would be a stroke from a lack of blood flow or clot in the brain or narrowing of blood vessels, and then the hemorrhagic stroke. So you can kind of look at it, a dry stroke and a wet stroke. There's the ischemic and hemorrhagic strokes.
Are the treatments different?
they are very different. And so that's why it's very important to get that CT scan right away so we can differentiate between what type of stroke the patient may be having. CT scans are extremely sensitive to bleeding in the brain. So if you are having bleeding in the brain, we want to try and reverse the bleeding if we're able to, and control blood pressure to make the bleeding lessen and not worsen. Ischemic strokes are a whole different ballgame where we are trying to either remove that clot or make sure that there's blood flow to the area that's not getting enough blood flow or oxygen.
We've heard of clot busting drugs.
Exactly. So that is one of the first line treatments that we, always entertain when people are coming into the emergency room. There are lots of different factors that will make people candidates for the thrombolytic medication. First off, you can't have any bleeding in the brain. Secondly, we look at your symptoms to make sure that it's consistent with a stroke, and then we look at what types of medications you've had, your prior history. But another prohibiting factor, which is one of the most important things with treatment for stroke, is time. That medication cannot be given further than 4.5 hours after the symptom onset. So as soon as you recognize symptoms, the faster that you come into the emergency department and we are able to determine if you're a candidate for it, the better recovery that you will have, hopefully, with symptoms if we're able to treat sooner.
Generally speaking, do you think people in North Dakota are having fewer strokes today because maybe there's been more education, about the same number, or is the problem maybe even getting worse?
I think when we have looked at data in North Dakota with the American Heart Association, because we have been part of a grant for Mission Lifeline here, and there was a lot of stroke education around calling 911. And I do believe that we have had an increase in the amount of patients that call 911 who are able to be treated sooner and have better outcomes.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a great thing.
What are the risk factors that people should really, really understand?
So with ischemic strokes and hemorrhagic strokes, one of our most modifiable risk factors, and it affects about half of the population in the United States, is high blood pressure. High blood pressure is one of the most common risk factors that we find with stroke patients. And so making sure that you are following with your primary care and keeping a close eye on your blood pressure. You know, that perfect number is less than 120 over 80, but working with your healthcare provider and your primary care to make sure that it remains at a good level will go a long ways in prevention of stroke.
Watched a video just this morning on a family friend whose young child had a stroke. This is not something you only need to worry about when you reach 50 or 60 or 70. Is that what you see?
We do see that. And unfortunately, we have been seeing younger and younger patients. And I think that, one of the things goes to there are more younger people in our society today that have high blood pressure and have diabetes. Smoking, used to be one of those big risk factors, and it still is. But I think, we've moved away from the tobacco use, but now there's vaping and all of these other things that are coming in with the younger generation too. So we definitely see strokes in young patients, not just because of the modifiable risk factors, but also things like, drug use, hormonal contraceptions, and those other types of risk factors that come with young patients as well.
We did a story here at Essentia Health maybe a month or 6 weeks ago about alcohol and its impact on cancer, but I have in my notes, alcohol may also be a lifestyle choice that can impact strokes.
Absolutely. So, there's alcohol use in moderation, which, one drink per night is something that they say that, shouldn't necessarily increase your risk for stroke, but definitely if you are engaging in alcohol use over 2 drinks per night, you are definitely at an increased risk for stroke as well.
What are the cool new interventions or treatments that you've been a part of here?
Yeah, so I've been with Essentia for 13 years, been with the stroke program for 10 years, and the newest device that we have to our stroke program would be the web device. And it's when we go back to the types of strokes, there's the bleeding stroke, the hemorrhagic strokes, and the ischemic strokes. On the hemorrhagic stroke side, Brain aneurysms that ruptured are a part of those hemorrhagic strokes. And the WEB device is a newer device that can treat different types of aneurysms. So very new technology. We're happy to have that available to us to treat different types of aneurysms here. And then on the thrombectomy side, so for pulling clots out with ischemic strokes, we've got lots of different techniques that we're able to use for that as well.
Most of my conversation to this moment has been with Megan Carbloom. She's a nurse practitioner in interventional neurology here at Essentia Health. I want to turn now to Chelsea Kuzna.
Hello.
Chelsea, you are a stroke program manager.
I am.
And you come into play after people have experienced a stroke. And boy, did our family learn a lot after that moment that my father had his stroke that I talked to Megan about just a moment ago. What's your role?
So my role as a stroke program manager is I look at our accreditation as a stroke center because, of course, at Essentia Health, we want to provide you with the best stroke care that we can in the region and hopefully in the United States. And so I focus a lot on staff education, on chart review, on making sure our processes are the best and evidence-based that they can be in the United States.
What do you do for folks? And when you first sit down with them, your father, your mother has had a stroke. Here we go.
Yes, so our program, we have not only myself as a program manager, but also a program educator. And so when you come to the hospital, you find out you had a stroke, we sit down with you and tell you, okay, here are your risk factors, here are the tests that we did, here's how we can control them in the future, and here's your new medications that you're gonna be on. Here's what therapy is recommending that you do in order to help you get back to as close as your baseline as you can get.
And some folks can get closer to that baseline than others.
Yes.
What support do families need to really assist that in the most positive way?
Education is key. We do so much explanation and education when a patient is in the hospital. And we try to also, you know, not only talk with them about it, but also provide resources that are written. So when you go home, you have something to review. So we give you a stroke book when you come here. We highlight all the tests that you get, all the risk factors that you're at risk for, you know, what you're going to see in the future. And our therapists work with you to decide, okay, can you go home? Do you need to go to a nursing home for a little bit? Can we come in your home and do therapy with you? So all of those are resources that we can give the patient and their family to be successful at home.
When my dad had his stroke, it was to the local hospital on a helicopter, gone.
Sure.
And then ultimately returned back home, where the resources in our small town weren't what they were in the larger community where he was initially treated for the stroke. Does that happen here in rural North Dakota as well?
Yes, so we can connect you with therapies and resources as close to home as possible. We also, for follow-up, because after the hospital, of course, you are going to follow with our team still. So we're going to call you at 5 days to check in on you, make sure your medications are okay, make sure you don't have any questions for at home. We're going to call you again at 90 days and see how you're doing at 90 days as well. So we're going to check in and see how therapy has gone. Do you still need to do therapy? You know, are you back home baseline? So we follow you throughout that whole journey and we meet you where you are. We also have opportunity for telehealth visits. So you can go to your local clinic and see us or see Megan right there in your local clinic, and we can do that follow-up with you there.
Tell me about the stroke support group. Who's it for and what services does that provide?
Yes, we love our stroke support group. This is where we get to connect with our stroke survivors. I think it's a common misconception that stroke is the end. And for a lot of our stroke patients, they go home and maybe you can't necessarily see what's going on with them, but they're still having symptoms. You know, maybe it's confusion or forgetfulness. Maybe you're having vision issues. And so at this support group, we get our stroke survivors and their family members around a table and we talk about what are you struggling with, what goes well, what helped for you. And then we also do volunteer opportunities. We bring in speakers at that support group. And so it's just a way to get information to our stroke survivors and their families on a continual basis. You know, we don't want to just send you out into the world without any information. And so it's an opportunity for us to keep connected with you.
Again, is that possible for folks who live far away from Fargo, from far away from Bismarck?
Absolutely. So you can, there are, you know, there's a list on the AHA actually of support groups. If you want to join our support group, we do have a virtual option. So if you're open to doing a virtual visit with the stroke support group, we can set that up for you. But you can also come into town and come to there physically as well.
Your most important advice for a family who's had a loved one who's just recently had a stroke?
I would say ask for help when you need it. Us as medical professionals, we want to care for people, and not only our patients but also the family. So we know what the resources are. So if you're struggling with something, mention it during an appointment, because we often, if we don't know the answer, well, you know how to find the answer, and we can connect you with those resources.
Megan, let me turn back to you. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you deal with in treating folks who've had a stroke or their families?
You know, one misconception I would say is that the injury happens in the heart. Lots of people think that stroke is, you know, a heart attack more so, but the injury is happening in your brain. And not all injuries are seen physically. So even if a patient has had a stroke and they don't have an arm that is not working or a leg that is not working, it does not mean that they are not struggling on a daily basis with their injuries. And so I think it's very important to keep in mind that stroke recovery does not happen quickly and it lasts a lifetime, which is why it's so important with the work that Chelsea and our team does with Stroke Support Group and all the resources that we're able to provide post-stroke.
Chelsea, would you add anything to that? Common misconceptions that folks have about strokes?
I think I would also add modifying a lifestyle for a patient is kind of key. You may not ever get back to your baseline. It's common not to get back to your baseline. And so finding ways that your new baseline is gonna work for you, that's what I think people don't realize. You know, you wanna go to the hospital, you wanna take a medication, and you wanna be better. But with stroke, it's really hard to get there because the effects are in your brain. And so it can last a lifetime. And so when you meet yourself where you are and you explain to your family members what you need, it's gonna make your whole life a little bit better because people are going to meet you where you're at.
The term resilience comes to mind.
Absolutely, yes. And our stroke survivors talk about that a lot. They struggle with asking people to make modifications, but that's okay. You know, your loved ones and your friends, they want to meet you where you're at, but it's hard to ask for that when you can't maybe always explain what's going on.
Megan, stroke, May is Stroke Awareness Month. Okay, now we all know that. What should listeners really be thinking about now that we've had a discussion about strokes?
I think it's really important that everybody remembers that stroke doesn't just affect the elderly, as we spoke about earlier. There are very young patients that have strokes too. So no matter what their age is, if there is any sudden onset of vision changes, speech changes, weakness anywhere in the body, you need to be calling 911 because time is of the essence with stroke care.
So there's a stroke walk coming up.
There is. This will be our fourth annual stroke walk at Essentia Health, and it is going to take place on Wednesday, May 28th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Rusted Recreation Center in West Fargo. We all know someone who's been affected by a stroke, so whether you're a stroke survivor, a family member, or staff that have taken care of a stroke patient, we encourage all to come out to that stroke walk and show support. The stroke walk is open to anyone who would like to join us. You do not have to have been a patient at Essentia Health.
Why have the walk? What does that bring to the community?
I think it brings awareness, A, to the community, and then B, it also shows that there's life after stroke. Our stroke patients like to be up and out and in the community. They know they have to make lifestyle changes, and a walk is a great way to represent that.
Megan, is there an opportunity for someone to get a stroke risk assessment?
Stroke risk assessments can be completed in, you know, a couple different ways. I think really starting with your primary care provider is very important to have your annual checkups. Again, looking at risk factors, where your blood pressure is at, where your cholesterol levels are at. Are you doing the work on your own with exercise, not smoking, eating a healthy diet? Mediterranean diet is typically what we're proposing to people if they want to change their diet. But then also, you know, taking advantage of the blood pressure machines that are, you know, in the malls, in the clinics, at your pharmacy, at your dentist. And if they are high, make sure you do follow up with your primary care.
So at Essentia Health, our stroke support group is the last Thursday of every month. In December, we typically have a holiday party, so that Thursday is usually different, but I just want people to know that they can come anytime. You don't have to have had your stroke at Essentia Health. And then if you are interested in coming, you can email strokesupportgroup@essentiahealth.org.
Hey, my guests have been Chelsea Kuzna, Stroke Program Manager at Essentia Health, and Megan Carboom. She's a nurse practitioner in interventional neurology.
As we promised, we're back in the Main Street studio, ready to ask you to become a sustaining member of Prairie Public. So important, especially right now. We'll be back to Main Street in just a moment. I want to remind you that today is the last day of Prairie Public Spring Membership Drive. We promised you that it would be short, and it is. And you can still double your impact. Every sustaining gift and upgrade is matched dollar for dollar, but only until 6 p.m. tonight. I'm Craig Blumenschein, host and producer of Main Street, here in studio with Tay Calloway. He's the board operator here at Prairie Public. Tay, how are you?
Doing pretty good.
Good, good. We're encouraging everyone to take a moment to invest in this trusted news, into trusted Main Street, and thoughtful stories that you can count on from Prairie Public.
Yes, like you were saying, Craig, when national headlines dominate the airwaves, it's local news that brings the story home. Prairie Public is where you hear the voices of your neighbors. It's where school board decisions, community concerns, and stories about rural life and local culture actually get the airtime they deserve. When severe weather shuts down roads or a policy change affects your town, you hear about it here. You hear it from someone who lives here, who knows the context, and who cares. And yet this kind of journalism doesn't happen on its own. It doesn't get funded by ad dollars. It's powered by you, every one of you. Today is the last day of our membership drive. And until 6 p.m., every sustaining gift and every upgrade will be matched dollar for dollar. So please, don't wait. Local journalism matters, and it depends on your action right now.
Tay made a great point. Our journalism happens from people who live right here in North Dakota. Whether it's stories like we brought to you yesterday about the genesis of the Make-A-Wish Foundation and its impact here in North Dakota, or even information that we just gave to you about strokes and how they're managed here in North Dakota, it's brought to you by people who live here. And we're asking that if public media matters to you, then now is the time to step up and invest in its future. When you give $100 a month or $1,200 a year, you join Prairie Public's Investor Circle, helping to fund the news, music, and storytelling that you depend on. And best of all, as we've said before, every time you tune in, you'll know that you played a role in making it happen. So how do you do all this? Whether you can give $5 a month or $100, you can support public media today by going online to prairiepublic.org or by calling us at 800-359-4145.
Yes, and like you were saying, Craig, Prairie Public is actually for me. I'm still the new guy here a little bit. And so this is actually where I started and where I actually first found my community. And there's everyone here that's been very helpful, and I'm thankful for you all.
And we are grateful that you are with us, Tay. And of course, like you, like me, I'm kind of new to North Dakota too, and Prairie Public has led the way in me discovering the state. All right, we'll get back to Main Street in just a moment. Up next is Todd McDonald. He's with you for the news.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For generations, Indigenous people have been fighting colonization and climate change to protect their culture. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Stella Samaripa, a Nimiipuu language teacher, about her efforts to bring Dog Bang back to Nez Perce lands.
Could you share a little bit about your project and how you blended ancestral knowledge in your project to restore Kemu, or Indian dogbane, habitats?
So we live in Kamyai, Idaho, and that actually is derived from our language, which is Kamyakpa, and that is like the gathering site, or it loosely translates to that as being the gathering site of Indian dogbane, or Kemu. And I started to like really get encompassed by that and entranced because, here we are living in this world world that our ancestors fought so hard to live in. Each and every plant around you, whether it be like the grass, tsichtsich, or lotus, right, being a flower, every single plant had a name. And it was that name was used for generations upon generations, time immemorial. And when we stop naming our plants and speaking to them, we start losing them. And that's exactly what happened here. And then I started talking to Sylvia Arquise with Northwest Indian College, and she was like, you can make this into a project, Stella. You can create a map all on your own. So she taught me GIS and how to actually pinpoint each place and create a map. And it was amazing to be able to understand what we as Nimiipuu or even as tribal people are capable of and how we can change our perspectives and we can use this technology for our benefit and for restoring our science.
Could you explain the cultural importance of Kemu within the Nimiipuu community? How does its restoration impact cultural practices?
I think learning about Kemu has really reawakened by knowledge, the power of gaining back our knowledge. You know, when we gain back what we lost, it feels right. It feels like we're, I guess, getting rid of a burden, you know, the burden of not knowing. We have this piece of a whole puzzle that we lost, and now we need to bring back and remake that piece so that we can have that whole outlook of being Nimiipuu.
As an Esperance language teacher, how do you see the connection between language revitalization and environmental restoration? Do these efforts complement each other in the work that you do?
I think they have a lot of connection. When we had our language and we were so fluent in that language, the plants, the lands, the animals, everything around us could hear us speak that language. And so when they were hearing us and they were listening to us, you know, they also had to have that connection with us in our language too. And you're starting to feel, again, that connection. And especially with like our language, you know, it's alive. And when we have so little of it, sure, it probably feels weak. Well, how can we strengthen that? And that's what we need to do, you know, like just everyday things.
In your research, how did traditional harvesting practices influence the restoration methods of Kemu?
We try to utilize every single piece of that plant. But what do we do with the things that we don't use from that plant? Well, traditionally speaking, we bring it back to the earth. And so when we're bringing back those pieces of the plant back into the soil, it's actually regaining its strength through the soil again, and it replenishes itself, so to speak. And then it starts to gain momentum in creating more populations. And that was what our ancestors knew. We treat it as a kinship, as being a relative for us. And how would you treat your child? How would you treat your grandchild? Or how would you treat your grandmother or your grandfather? Do they take care of us? So we need to take care of them.
Is there anything else that you would like to share about what Kemu teaches us about resilience, restoration, or just the future of Indigenous science?
I think there's a lot of resilience in our plants. Kemu was put on the noxious weeds list for, you know, decades, right? It was meant to be completely exterminated. And here it is, still finding its way back to us. And, you know, that resilience is the same way with us, right? We have been near genocide and we were supposed to be exterminated. And here we are still alive. We're still talking to each other, you know, and the connection is there. We just need to find that again.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Craig Blumenschein in the Main Street studio. We're reminding you that Main Street A will return shortly, but most importantly, right at this moment, that today again is your final chance to take part in something big, and that's a dollar for match on all sustaining and upgraded gifts, but it ends at 6 p.m. tonight. That's how public radio works. Listeners, just like you, stepping up when it matters, and we're grateful for those who support Prairie Public. Again, I'm Craig Blumenschein. I'm the host and producer of Main Street. I'm here with Tay Calloway.
Yes.
We're inviting you to be one of the great supporters of public media here in North Dakota. You can go to prairiepublic.org, click on that donate button, or give us a call at 800-359-4145. Tay, it's pretty easy to do.
Yes, indeed. People who contribute to Prairie Public give us a lot of reasons for doing so. Some say they appreciate the value they get out of the station. People love Eric's promos or hearing Todd give a joke during live pitch. And others say they wish to support an alternate to commercial stations. And then there are some that feel obligated to contribute because all they do is listen to Prairie Public every day. But how about this reason? Prairie Public serves your community. Whether it's during a crisis or in the lead up to an important election, we're here providing the information this community needs. Make a contribution to Prairie Public right now, not just for you, but for the whole community. Call 800-359-4145 or give online at prairiepublic.org.
Tay just mentioned that word, and it was you. You, our listener. And that's why Prairie Public exists. That's why public media exists, for that one simple reason. Government funding helps, but it's your support, our listener support, that's most significant, the most significant part of funding here at Prairie Public. And because of that, we play no commercials, which I think is awesome. We keep our reporting honest, our storytelling strong as we can, and our programming tailored to your curiosity about the world and our prairie region. We cannot do it without you. And when public media is at risk, which it is today, your support matters even more. Donate now at prairiepublic.org. Click that donate button. We'll be grateful. Or you can give us a call at 800-359-4145.
Yes, we believe in being your honest broker for this region, bringing you stories, news, and insights you can trust. You rely on us to go beyond the headlines, giving you facts, primary sources, and a clear picture of who did what. We're here to connect you not only with what's happening today, but also with the events of the past that shape our present. We provide the context, not just the what, but how and why. Today, we're asking for your support to keep this vital service going. If Prairie Public has been your go-to for reliable news and thoughtful programming, please consider making the donation by giving us a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org.
As I said just a moment ago, federal support really does help Prairie Public reach rural and tribal communities, classrooms, and households that commercial media ignores. And without it, those most in need of free, accessible content, well, they're the first to lose out. So our mission is universal service, not just for those who can afford it. Your gift helps Prairie Public. It helps us continue broadcasting educational kids programming, emergency alerts, and cultural content across the prairie region. When public funding is threatened, as it is today, community support is how we keep our signal strong from the Red River Valley to the Badlands and beyond. Don't wait. prairiepublic.org. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. After devastating floods in 2019, a Nebraska farmer enrolled nearly all of her land in the Federal Conservation Reserve Program to prevent erosion and restore wildlife habitat. While CRP has long supported rural communities by paying landowners to take environmentally sensitive land out of production, it now faces political threats, funding cuts, and uncertainty as the farm bill nears expiration, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
When a storm unleashed devastating flooding across Nebraska in 2019, Judith Punchikar watched as part of her family's farm was reclaimed by the Middle Loup River.
When the rain came down so hard, this land just washed right into the river. That was my land all the way to the dead trees. So that's 8 acres here that I lost.
The Punchikar family has owned the small farm just outside of St. Paul, Nebraska for more than a century. By the time Punchikar returned to live on the farm full-time in 2020, she knew she needed to do something to prevent further erosion. When she called the local Farm Service Agency office for advice, they told her about a federal program they administer called the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. Now, most of the 153 acres of her farm are enrolled in that program.
I think I'm the only farm in the area that has my entire farm in the CRP program. We're not talking a whole lot of acres, but that's a lot of acres for me.
The CRP was established in the 1985 Farm Bill with the goal of reducing soil erosion. Landowners receive an annual rental payment for taking environmentally sensitive land out of production for 10 to 15 years. They then implement conservation practices, which the government helps pay for. Jesse Womack, a policy specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, says the program has become a mainstay of the rural landscape.
It does so much for quality of life in rural communities. It offers farmers an alternative means of cash flow if they have acreage that, needs rest, isn't the most productive.
In the current political climate, some wonder if CRP will survive. The program is under the Farm Service Agency, which is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA, like many federal agencies, has been hit hard by layoffs and funding cuts. And Project 2025, the blueprint for a second Trump administration, explicitly called for the CRP program to be eliminated.
I think that the actions of the last few months have clearly illustrated that there is nothing that is not on the table.
That's Zachary Ducheneau, who led the Farm Service Agency in former President Joe Biden's administration. He worries the program could be targeted by the current administration during farm bill negotiations. And even if CRP survives, Ducheneau says recent firings and funding cuts have already stretched the Farm Service Agency to the breaking point.
There is no way the department or the agency is going to be able to tighten its belt or streamline or find efficiencies just because someone says so.
There are other signs that federal support for CRP is lagging. The annual sign-up for the program hasn't been announced yet. A USDA spokesperson says the agency is, quote, evaluating conservation goals and priorities. And funding authority for the CRP runs out in September with the expiration of the Farm Bill extension. Still, Jesse Womack says he'd be surprised if the program was eliminated. He grew up hunting on CRP land in Minnesota and says the program has broad support from hunters, environmentalists, and farmers alike.
I would find it shocking if there was not some bipartisan collaboration to protect CRP if a material threat emerged.
Back on Punchakar's farm in Nebraska, a woodpecker drums on a large oak tree. Though the conservation practices are still in their early stages, Punchakar says she's already noticing a difference.
And the seeds are just getting started, but I have never seen so many pollinators before, so many different kinds of wasps and different kinds of bees.
Since her CRP contracts were signed recently, Punchakar knows she will continue to be paid for her work over the next decade. But she hopes the conservation projects on her farm will last far longer. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Molly Ashford.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
Trees know an eclipse is coming before it starts. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
According to a law passed in 1990, every 4 years, the federal government is required to issue the National Climate Assessment about the effects of global warming on the U.S. Now, the Trump administration has dismissed 400 scientists involved in the report, saying they are no longer needed, and it is being reevaluated.
The report is unlike the UN's climate documents because it shows what's happening on the local, regional, and national levels to weather patterns, and it helps prepare for the future.
Two private organizations, the American Meteorological Society and the American Geophysical Union, have said they will step in and together produce the assessment, which is due in 2027.
The last climate assessment was issued in 2023. It concluded, among other things, that the harmful impacts of climate change in the U.S. were increasing as extreme events and hazards intensified.
There are concerns in the scientific community that the Trump administration will issue its own report using alternative views on climate change.
In Congress last week, members of the House Natural Resources Committee sparred over whether potential seabed mining for critical minerals could lead to environmental damage.
Studies show that vacuuming up the seabed to harvest minerals could have devastating impacts on marine life and biodiversity by, for example, creating sediment plumes and noise pollution.
The hearing came just after the Metals Company, a Canadian firm, submitted the first application ever to the U.S. government to mine in international waters between Hawaii and Mexico. Trump recently signed an executive order to expedite seabed mining permits.
Democrats counter that the need for cobalt and nickel is shrinking because electric vehicle manufacturers are shifting to batteries that don't use them.
Trump's order ignores an effort underway by the UN International Seabed Authority that seeks to regulate mineral extraction outside territorial waters. However, the U.S. is not a member of the organization.
Other countries denounced Trump's order. France has urged a moratorium on seabed mining until more is known about its impact.
A new study out last week found that plastic pollution is accumulating in all depths of the ocean, not just in swirling eddies at the surface, but all the way down to the seafloor.
In that toxic mix are splintering fragments of water bottles, packaging, fishnets, and sanitary pads. Yes, disposable sanitary pads, which are composed of several layers of plastic, often end up in the ocean, with an estimated 55,000 tons of the waste in North American water bodies each year alone.
Various sustainable alternatives have been promoted, but they've not gained market share due to higher production costs. But a solution may be in the offing. Researchers have developed a biodegradable sanitary pad made from cornstarch.
The cornstarch yields a material called polylactic acid, or PLA, which can replace plastic. Given that corn is one of the most widely grown crops in the world, manufacturing the pads could be affordable and easily integrated into production methods.
There are some potential downsides. PLA could create a higher demand for farmland, along with an increased use of fertilizers and pesticides. Also, the material requires industrial composting to biodegrade.
That said, the sanitary pads would have a lower climate and environmental footprint than traditional ones that rely on fossil fuels and have a more toxic manufacturing process.
And finally, throughout history, humans have reacted to solar eclipses with emotions ranging from fear to awe. Research has shown that animals respond, with some resorting to nighttime behaviors and others clustering together for safety.
But according to a new study, trees also know something's going down. They can sense an eclipse long before it starts and send out warnings to younger trees who might not know what to expect.
Evolutionary ecologist Monica Galliano from Southern Cross University in Australia led a study in which her team attached sensors to spruce trees of various ages in the Dolomites of Italy to monitor their bioelectrical impulses during an eclipse in 2022.
They found that electrical activity of all trees became synchronized before and during the one-hour eclipse, with older specimens having a more pronounced response nearly 14 hours before younger ones. After the event ended, all the plants went back to business as usual.
The authors suggest the trees might have sensed the eclipse because of gravimetric tides, which are subtle shifts in Earth's gravity influenced by the alignment of the sun and moon.
During a solar eclipse, the team says older trees with a more expansive root system could pick up on these changes and remember them, similar to how plants might anticipate seasonal changes.
The authors say the tree's electrical activity can influence an ecosystem's resilience, biodiversity, and overall function by helping it cope with rapid changes, adding that the findings underscore the importance of protecting old-growth forests, especially in light of climate change.
This notion that trees communicate in this and previous research by the team has drawn some skepticism. But Galliano insists this recent study furthers the science, and the data show that we are, quote, watching the famous Wood Wide Web in action.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
One of the great memories I'll take with me for a long, long time, Tay Calloway, who's on the other side of the Main Street studio, is being at 100% of solar eclipse when it happened in Wyoming a few years ago. Have you ever seen one?
Oh, you know, this just happened like a few years ago, right?
Right.
I did exactly what they tell you not to do. I looked at it. And I feel like I regret doing that. But yes, it was beautiful when I saw it. I felt like I had no choice but to take a peek.
Incredible. We were at 100%, so we could look at it when it was in totality and be safe about it. And that was just a wonderful thing. I'm Craig Blumenschein. I'm joined by Tay Calloway, our board operator here at Prairie Public. And we're asking you to remember that public radio doesn't happen without support from listeners just like you. And today is your last chance to make twice the impact. Every sustaining dollar will be upgraded, and you can make your gift, you can make your donation to Prairie Public, your support, until 6 p.m., and we'll match it dollar for dollar. This is the last day of the pledge drive, and this is the last short pledge break. We're encouraging you to call 800-359-4145 or go online at prairiepublic.org and consider being a pledging member.
Yes, and this is just one simple step. Become a new sustainer or upgrade your current monthly gift, and you'll double your impact instantly. Thanks to a generous match by Janet and Paul Martineau of Sydney, Montana, your increase or new gift is automatically matched. New form, no forms, no codes, just more power behind your support. Sustainers are the foundation of Prairie Public's future, and your monthly gift helps us a lot, and it helps secure the news that we deliver.
We've had a wonderful pledge drive so far. You can still make it even better. And to those who have pledged during this pledge break, we just have one thing to say. Thank you. Thank you so very much, because public media and Prairie Public is powered by listeners just like you, not advertisers and not shareholders. I want to let you know that if you can give at $100 a month level, and that's a tall task for many, but for some, it's a good thing. You're making a powerful statement. You believe in independent journalism, rich storytelling, and music that brings people together. Your $1,200 annual contribution would be part, make you part of our investor circle. Call right now, prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 6th. Hermann Stern arrived in North Dakota from Germany in 1903 to work at the Strauss clothing store in Castleton, which was owned by his cousin. He became the manager of the company's second store in Valley City and made his home there for the next 70 years. Hermann became a community leader and an enthusiastic booster of North Dakota. He was active in the Rotary and the Masons and was a strong supporter of the Boy Scouts. Seeking a way to boost North Dakota business and encourage tourism, Hermann founded the Greater North Dakota Association in 1924 and served as its first president. That organization is known today as the Greater North Dakota Chamber. On this date in 1933, the association announced it would sponsor a summer tourist excursion to the Badlands. The trip would be made in cooperation with the Northern Pacific Railroad, with a round-trip fare from Fargo set at $3. The association believed the trip would interest North Dakotans who had never had a chance to visit what is called some of the most scenic and attractive points in the state. As the country continued to struggle with the effects of the Great Depression, the trip was expected to appeal to people with limited vacation dollars. The hope was that North Dakotans would keep those vacation dollars within the state. The citizens of Dickinson planned to assist with the tour by providing free automobile transportation from Dickinson to Medora. Points of interest on the itinerary included Dickinson, Painted Canyon, Peaceful Valley Ranch, Teddy Roosevelt's Ranch, and the Desmoures Chateau. The list of activities had not yet been finalized, but proposed events included a parade of cowboys and cowgirls, a display of horsemanship, and an outdoor barbecue. Interest in the excursion exceeded expectations, and tickets were going fast. So many people signed up for the Badlands trip that there were not enough vehicles in Dickinson to take them all to Medora. Those who could not go by car were taken to Medora by train. Over 1,900 people joined the expedition, and the association considered it a wild success. The organization did not waste any time on planning a second trip. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you still have time to participate in our Spring 2025 Pledge Drive by going to prairiepublic.org and clicking on Donate. That's the easiest way to become a sustaining member of Prairie Public and support the voices you hear each and every day across North Dakota and the Prairie region. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about Sylvan Learning Centers, who are working with schools and parents to enhance education right here in North Dakota. We look forward to seeing you again on Main Street.